The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show EDU edition, where we continue on our journey today through the detailed description of our philosophy and approach to retirement planning and putting together a what we call a base retirement plan. This is part three. This is part four, actually. We've done three shows so far in this series. The first two were really philosophy. We didn't tell you how, but really is all about the why we do things the way we do. Part three, which we did last time, we created a kind of a fictitious couple with some details I'll share with you in a minute, and talked then about covering what we refer to as the minimum dignity floor and assessing the secure income and its ability to cover that. What do we do if it doesn't look like it's going to cover it? Those types of details. Today, we're going to move forward into the next phase, talking about fun things or the desired expenses. But before we do that, I want to remind everybody of our fictitious couple that we've been honestly, we've just been spontaneously building this couple as we go. We just blurt out whenever we get to a point where we need a number, we just make something up. So just so we can stay consistent, I've been taking notes as we create this fictitious couple. And this couple in our example that we're walking through our process with is a 62-year-old couple, and they they're retiring and have $3 million worth of liquid assets at retirement. We assessed last week their minimum dignity floor and the coverage of such, and that minimum dignity floor coverage with secure income looked like it was pretty good until about 80, when we see what we refer to in-house as a crossover, in that the inflation of the minimum dignity floor expenses, which are food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, as a reminder, overcame the any inflation adjustments to their secure income, which for this couple is Social Security, and the wife has a pension, a joint and 50% survivorship style pension. And we, in our hypothetical here, we said that at 80, they start to see a shortage of coverage of the minimum dignity floor expenses with that secure income in the form of $6,000 per year going forward, increasing, though, at 6% per year. And last time, I told you how we would solve for that. We would get a quote for income in the form of a SPIA, a single premium immediate annuity, that behaves like we identified that shortage. So we're looking for what it would take to hand money over to an insurance company to then pay the couple $6,000 a year, growing at 6% per year indefinitely till the second passing. And I just made up, well, what if it cost us $200,000 to do that? Well, that was at age 80. It's not $200,000 today. So in our approach, we take that $200,000 and roll it back to today when they're 62, so 18 years back, and we figure out what will it take to set aside today, because that's the idea. We want the 62-year-olds to set aside money to protect the minimum dignity floor of the 80-year-old and beyond. And in my hypothetical, I said, well, maybe they need about $100,000 today at age 62 that they could invest very conservatively, which would grow hopefully to the $200,000, and then they'd have the money to buy an annuity at that time if they chose to. And we've reminded people throughout this whole process, when we talk about valuing these basic income annuities, it's really just for the purpose of understanding what resources need to be devoted to covering the minimum dignity floor. It isn't saying you will go buy or you shall go buy this annuity. That's not the point. The point is we need a good, robust estimate of what it would cost to generate the income that would behave like we want it to behave in the form of regular, recurring, predictable income that we can rely upon that grows at the same rate as we're seeing the shortage grow, and it goes on until the second of the couple passes away. The last piece before we get to the fun stuff today, at the end of last show, I mentioned that the delay period, so we refer to the point of retirement, which is 62 for these folks, until their secure income is fully on, which in this example, the wife was going to delay Social Security claiming till age 70. So it isn't until she turns 70 that all their secure income has been fully throttled up to its full amount that it's ever going to be. That we call the delay period. So for them, they have about an 8-year delay period before their secure income is fully engaged. And I put out, well, let's assume that they need about $600,000 in order to fund the minimum dignity floor during that delay period. And you notice I didn't say anything about an annuity here. We don't recommend annuitizing for an immediate need that has an identifiable end date. That's actually pretty easy to plan for, especially when you're at the beginning of retirement. And I mentioned before, they have $3 million of liquid assets. So at this time, they have the assets to fund their 7-8 year long delay period until the secure income starts. So to wrap things up, they start with $3 million at 62. They need to, in our approach, set aside $100,000 to protect the 80-year-old and beyond coverage of the minimum dignity floor, and they need another $600,000 set aside dedicated just to covering those minimum dignity floor expenses from today until the wife turns 70. So they're at $2.3 million at this point of liquid assets, because we've carved off that $700,000 for the purposes I just described. And that brings us to today, Jim. So very long summary, but I wanted to get everybody up to speed.
No, that was excellent. And that was excellent to lay the groundwork. And I'm certain a lot of our listeners fall into a very similar scenario so they can see how we do it and how they need to do it. If you guys are do-it-yourselfers and you're trying to do it. And it also is lending, I hope, a better understanding to you out there. I chatted with a couple today, Chris. Mm-hmm. Not a couple people, but a couple. Mm-hmm. From the West Coast. I won't say what state. And the husband shared with me that they got a retirement analysis done, and he didn't like it. And I asked him to, and he had some concern with it. Mm-hmm. And he was wondering what our methodology was. And I mentioned these podcasts that he mm-hmm. may want to listen to them. Mm-hmm. Apparently, his wife was the one who listens to us most, not him. Mm-hmm. But anyways, I walked him through. But before I did, I said to him, can you share with me what you didn't like about mm-hmm. the retirement plan you got? Mm-hmm. You have no idea, because I haven't talked to you about this.
No.
What do you think he didn't like about the retirement plan he got?
They told him a dollar amount he could spend every year, just a flat rate adjusted for inflation, but with some strange assumption that their spending behavior would be linear and it would just go on and all expenses are created equal.
Close, that was one of them. But it was the conclusion of the plan gave him a certain
percentage chance of success.
That was it.
Yeah.
Yep,
that's the
I knew you
piece.
Would get it. Yeah. I had to give you a little.
So they were giving him probably some
probability.
They did a probability analysis
and
or a Monte Carlo.
And he said the same thing yeah. you mm-hmm. always say. He says, and they gave me a number that said, and I can't remember if he had a 80 or 83 or a 9, or I forget what it was, either 80 or 90 or 93% chance. And he asked me, what am I supposed to do if I'm in there? Meaning mm-hmm. it failed.
Right. Because it's not zero. They're telling him straight up if they say you have an 83% chance of success, even if those numbers are reliable. So let's assume they are.
And
we
not.
Could have a whole other discussion
yes,
about
yes.
that. But let's assume that their method is robust and you could rely on that number. The other way of looking at that is they're telling him you have a 17% chance of failure. And then they never follow up on describing what their life would be like in the fail mode, which 17% chance... That's not insignificant.
Nope.
That means 17 out of 100 people in their same circumstances are going to be in that boat. I bet those 17 people want to know what the heck their life's going to be like in a failure.
Well, I said to him, let me explain our process. He was a physician. Mm-hmm. I said, because I'm telling you now, if I had a condition and Dr. One said to me, 90% of my patients get through this okay, and Dr. Two said to me, 100% of my patients get through this okay, I said, I'm going to Dr. Two. And he understood that. Mm-hmm. And then I shared with him our process. Mm-hmm. And I, again, don't lose sight of this fact, folks, that I just explained to you, why we don't like probability withdrawal-based plans. As Chris said initially, he thought the gentleman shared with me he didn't like the fact that they were going to give him a linear amount to spend on all expenses. That was one of the things he told me he didn't like about that plan, but he liked about ours after I walked him through it. Mm-hmm. But the main one was the probability. Mm-hmm. And he was fixating on, what if I am one of those?
Right.
And the key, he said to me, they had no answer when I asked them.
No, no.
I mean, what do? You just stare at the client and say, I don't know.
No, you keep redirecting them and aiming at the success stories. That's what typically is done. Not that you wouldn't find an honest, upfront advisor using this technique that would then describe to you what your situation looks like in the failure that they're describing. But that's not typical.
So I walked him through that our approach to retirement isn't uncertainty-based, which is what the probability approach is. It is uncertain. Mm-hmm. It's an uncertainty-based approach. And we take a certainty-based approach by getting people to understand there are a certain level of expenses that will continue forever. Chris just walked you through this whole first phase of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, and how we believe in mapping them or matching them, whichever word you want to use, to income that will also last as long as you live, whether you have money or not. That's our whole first part. Listen to last week's podcast on it. Then I shared with him our approach to going into fun spending, F-U-N, fun spending. That it's an explicit promise the younger you has to make the older you that your minimum dignity floor is covered. And in return, the older you is wanting to give the younger you the explicit comfort to spend on fun. But it's not as clear as I'm making it out to be. So follow our logic on what we do in step two. But the doctor understood, and he was very pleasurable to chat with about aging and how our bodies and minds go. I mean, he fully understood all of that. So listen to our first two podcasts on this. This is podcast four. If you haven't listened to the first three, but especially the first two, we get into aging and what happens to us and why we believe in covering food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare with guaranteed income. But let's look at the fun and why we don't believe in covering fun with guaranteed income unless there's excess guaranteed income. Mm-hmm. If there's excess, great.
Spend it on fun stuff, yeah.
But it's not a requirement. But more importantly, what Chris thought the person I spoke to today from the West Coast was going to say, he didn't like, or they didn't like, because the husband and wife I spoke with, they wouldn't like the linear approach to fun spending. Because this is a thorn in Chris's side. Because Chris always says on this podcast, one of the things he hates about the probability approach is they fixate on just the probability of failure. And to solve that, they restrict what you spend. That's how you increase the probability. Mm-hmm. Well, gee, you don't like this 83% chance? You want a better than that? Well, if we reduce your spending by 50%, I'm just making that up, but you reduce it by 50, I can increase your probability to 99. They'll never say 100, I don't think. Have you ever seen one that says 100?
No.
I imagine they exist.
That was an accident if they did.
You don't think someone who had $6 million and is spending $50,000 a year?
It's beat into people not ever to say that.
Really?
Because it implies no chance of
possible
failure.
So you don't
think
there's no probability that would show 100? I don't know. We don't do probability, so I don't use the software. But
No. The actual software, the statistical analysis will show 100.
Okay.
Yes.
The advisor's not going to say
100. The advisor's
not going
to say. I said they're never going to tell you that.
No, his compliance department won't let him say 100.
Yeah. No.
That I can tell you. Right. But the software might actually print out 100.
Right.
Okay. So back to what we do, folks, for the fun. So in Chris's
Oh, wait a minute. You got to clarify why I don't like that approach that I always point out to people. We reduce it and get a really small chance of you not running out of money, but they never point out the other end of the what we call the probability distribution. When they run this, the reason how they figure this out is they run a hypothetical retirement for you hundreds or thousands of times, let the software introduce variability and things like that, and show you in all these thousand times we simulated you retiring, only 1% of the time or 10% of the time or whatever the failure rate is, did it, quote, fail. What they're forgetting to tell you is just as many times you end up on the other end of the spectrum where you end up with a ton of money left over. And that's, they never call that a fail, but that's a fail in my book because it said that you unnecessarily restricted your spending while in retirement, watching your assets just grow and grow and grow and grow and grow.
And then you never spent them, but whoever you left them to would. Yeah. And as Chris always points out, if that was your ultimate goal, then it's not a failure.
Right.
But if your goal was to enjoy what life you had left, doing things you enjoy doing, because you know there's no do-over. You don't start all over again. Right. That's where he considers it a failure. But there are some people, we had one who emailed us, vehemently disagreed with our approach on this because he wanted to leave as big an inheritance as possible. Mm-hmm. And we advocate spend your money, don't leave it. So that's just the way we approach. And we read his email. We acknowledged.
Yeah. If that was your goal, there's no problem with that.
That was your goal. Go ahead and do it. We do not have any problem with someone who shares, my goal, Jim, is to optimize my inheritance to my children at the expense of me having fun. And I have no problem with that. But a lot of people don't share in that belief.
Right.
Okay. And one thing I want to add, if you are working with another advisor, what Chris was saying, they're going to use the terminology iteration. So just if you ever hear that verbiage, hey, we ran 10,000 iterations, it's what Chris just described. Each iteration, if you will, is a different retirement scenario, mostly a different rate of return. Do some iterations change the actual withdrawal percentages too, or is it all just based on return?
The standard Monte Carlo approach, the variability they're introducing is in the sequence and size of the returns on the investments.
Okay, they're not looking at the withdrawals.
They're not looking at the actual withdrawals.
So they don't vary those.
But you can do that. You can force it to run a combined thing and then also
change.
They could input changes to the spending behavior. But yeah, it's usually we need to spend X amount. They have the client say, my budget is this. I need to spend fill in the blank $60,000 a year, whatever it is. We know how much liquid assets they have now. The software is just going to introduce variable randomized returns over the retirement years and to see if the portfolio will sustain itself and not run out.
Perfect.
And they run that hundreds or thousands of iterations to
see. So now you're up to phase two. You have a little better understanding of a few things, I'm hoping. What do we do with the fun? Well, again, a hypothetical client had $3 million. After all the subtractions Chris did, what are they down to?
$2.3 million now because they started with three and we needed $700,000 to protect the long-term identified or projected shortage. We don't know exactly what it's going to be, but it just shows the trends that there's going to be a possible shortage.
I thought it was $200,000.
Hang on, $200,000 then, but they need $100,000 now. Set aside for
now.
It, and then another $600,000 for the delay period.
Gotcha. Okay, so that $700,000 comes out of your three. The first thing, all you do-it-yourselfers, get through your heads. That $700,000 is still there.
Yeah,
we're just talking accounting. That's all.
Right.
You're still managing it. It's still at Vanguard. You Vanguardians, don't worry about that. But in your mind, you have accounted for it, and you're saying to yourself, that $700,000 can't be spent today. I have to reserve that. So I'm really entering retirement with $2.3 million. But my food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care, at least under today's assumptions, is covered.
Right.
Mm-hmm. With my money and my secure income.
And let me point out now, taking that approach, we've answered the question, what happens if I run out of money, quote, you know, quote. In our version, since you've reserved that and it's not really considered money to spend on fun things and other things you might want to identify, there's certainly things you'd spend it on that I wouldn't put call fun, but other things outside the minimum dignity floor. If you happen to spend that other $2.3 million, you still have your minimum dignity floor covered. That's the difference. You have a safety net, a line.
As long as you don't cross the line and spend your reserve. That money is off limits.
Correct.
Okay. So now we call, and you will call, listeners, that $2.3 million, write this down, your preliminary fund number. I didn't necessarily mean for you to write it down. I meant for listeners.
Well, I'm
going
to keep notes so that we can keep this story going into the next show.
So your preliminary fund number, fund, F-U-N. Some people think I'm saying fund number. I'm saying fund.
Yeah, and it's not an acronym. It's not F-U-N. No, it's actually fund. Like you're doing fun stuff. Yeah,
fun stuff. We call that your preliminary fund number because we're not saying at this point of your analysis or our analysis, if we're doing it for someone, we're not saying go out, spend $2.3 million like junk sailors on shore leave. As long as you save that $700,000 off to the side and your Social Security and pension are what we thought, you're okay. That would be ridiculous. It is your preliminary fund number. And what we want to do now is apply something to that number that you, as a do-it-yourself investor, have not had to deal with yet. And what is that there, good sir? What do you think it is?
Well, we want to see if the expenses you envision your retirement incurring above the minimum dignity floor, if those assets through withdrawals might likely sustain that level of spending.
Exactly. What Chris said in English, negative withdrawals.
Yeah, you're starting
You've only had positive additions to your portfolio during the accumulation phase. That's nothing. That's easy. It only goes up. Only more money goes in. I'm not saying your portfolio only goes up. The performance of the market can send it up and down. But 73 or 78, I forget what percent, 73 or 78% of any given year, the market is up. So you've only experienced, for the most part, a lot of up markets, but more importantly, positive cash flow.
Right, you're putting money in.
Going in. Negative cash flow changes the math on everything. And you haven't experienced negative cash flows yet. Because let me tell you, in retirement, the first one you do is going to freak you out. And part of what we're trying to do is keep you from getting freaked out. So we've got to really make sure that $2.3 million preliminary fund number is truly the amount of money that you can spend like drunk sailors on shore leave. So what we're going to do is walk you through our approach to coming up with what we call your fund spending glide path. New term that we may not have used on the podcast. I don't know. Fund spending glide path. It references a simple fact that we talk about all the time on our show. Fun spending, unlike minimum dignity floor spending, which is very methodical, but moderately increases every year, never stops, not exposed to any variability, not exposed to any volatility, and not exposed to much emotions. In other words, you've got to always cover food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare. Fun spending, total opposite. It's extremely volatile. Some days or weeks you're going to spend more than others. Some years more than others. It's extremely variable. One year might be a chill year. Next year you might go on four trips. And it is totally emotionally driven. Fun spending is emotionally driven. You're going out to get those endorphins excited, that part of our brain that is, oh my God, this was great. And that is emotionally driven. So if your portfolio is down, if your 2.3 million was down to 1.15 million, it lost half its value in a market correction, you're probably going to cut your spending, which is sad because you'll cut it. You can only cut fun. Minimum dignity floor is hard to cut. And if it's covered the way we cover it, it's protected with secure income anyways, then you're going to sacrifice the fun you do. But we'll get into that on another show when we talk about how to position your fund number for spending. Right now, we're trying to come up with how do you go from preliminary to final fund number? Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing you got to do is look at the preliminary number and give it your preliminary fund spending trajectory.
I would argue you don't have to do this. You could jump right to the next phase, but we like to do it. I describe it to people all the time as we're going to come at your fund spending from two different directions. The one direction is we're going to ask you, what list of fun things do you imagine doing? What have you been thinking about that would keep you happy doing fun things? What are the trips you want to do, the entertainment, the dining out, the going to shows, the buying football tickets, season tickets, going fishing, hunting, hobbies? You know, the list goes on and on and on. What have you been thinking? And they give us essentially a budget for those things. And the first thing we do is ask, kind of try to show people, does it look like that's a reasonable budget to be spent from, in this case, the $2.3 million? And so we model that and we show people that, their version of that. Now, when I say we come at it two different directions, more recently, and this is what people are really getting excited about, I think. This is where people really show interest in our approach. And that is we'll come at it the other direction. Instead of you telling us what you imagine spending and we then predict or project if that's likely to be sustained by your assets, we instead say, let's do our process, get to your final fund number, and now we can tell you what you could spend. And it might be a whole lot more than you had in your preliminary kind of dreams you've been having, because most people create those without really having an understanding of what is the potential of their money, what is the potential of all the savings, this deferred spending we talk about, to go have fun with. And that we do the other direction, which is our final fund number. But in this preliminary phase, we want to give people just a glimpse. Does it look like at least your basic list of fun stuff you gave us looks reasonable given your assets outside of your minimum dignity floor coverage?
So a lot of times people say to us, well, guys, we never really thought of this. So what I say is, first of all, put aside any once-in-a-lifetime bucket list items. It's not what we're looking for right now at this phase of the analysis. So when you try to come up with your fund spending glide path and the trajectory of it, and you might be wondering, what the hell is Jim talking about, glide path trajectory? I'll walk you through it. So what we begin with is say, put aside any of these one-off, I really want to go on a trip around the world for $180,000. You're not going to do that every year. I mean, some people might want to try, but put aside those bucket list items. That's the word I was looking for. And what I say to people, at the end of the first year in retirement, it's December 31st, New Year's Eve. You're approaching your second year of retirement, and the two of you are outside looking at the stars or whatever. What would it take for both of you to look at each other and say, we had a really good year? As far as fun, I'm not talking about health and all this other stuff. As far as fun things. So start adding up for me, and I give myself as an example because I know me best. I'll say for me, I would like to have gone on my annual elk hunting trip. I would like to have gone on two fishing trips, maybe one to Canada and one to Alaska. So two fishing trips, my elk hunting trip. I'd love to go to more shows. I don't go to enough shows. I like live shows. Mm-hmm. So I probably would have tried to make it to Red Rocks a little bit more or to other shows. And I start adding up what those would all cost.
And even more mundane things like dining out.
Dining out, oh, absolutely.
Subscriptions to things you might do.
Gardening for me.
Gardening. So that's what I mean by kind of a budget for this thing. It's
exactly.
The budget that accomplishes a list that creates the feeling that Jim described. At the end of the year, on New Year's Eve, you feel like you had a pretty good year of fun stuff.
In year one. So it's going to be much more active than in year 20 of my retirement.
Mm-hmm.
So follow our logic here. We specifically, and as we talk to people, describe it that way. Tell me at the end of year one, not at the end of year 30, the end of year one. So let's just say you add it all up and it came to $45,000, making that up again. So at the end of year one, for you to have said, we had a really good time, it would have cost about $45,000. Do not care about the accuracy of that number, folks, please. It could have been 48, could have been 52, might be 37 one year. We're looking for trends, not accuracy. I know that sounds odd, but too many people, Chris, too many people, God, that hurt, trying to get your name out of the back of my head.
Answer to Steve now.
Too many people, I almost called you Pete. Too many people, I think, get paralysis by analysis. They overanalyze it. They don't know what to do, and they get all flustered. And I tell them, if you don't know by now what you enjoy doing, just go through a typical life. Now, add more to it because you're retired. That's why I said I want two trips fishing, not one. So you're going to be doing a little bit more. Add it all up, comes to $45,000. Mm-hmm. Now, you're going to be in the go-go years first, we tell our clients. So then Chris does this part of the analysis. He'll be chatting to you about life expectancy, looking at your current age. Most people, the go-go phase, the phase where you have the health, inclination, and desire, that last one is key, desire, to do fun things might last for most people 8 to 12 years. People who retire earlier than normal could be 15 to 18. People who retire later than normal, 68, 70, 71, it might be 6 years. But what he's looking to do is predict or project, just the projection, we're only looking for the trend, of a reasonable length of time for this go-go phase. And then at the end of that go-go, he'll put in again the slow-go phase, which lasts about 10 years, and then the no-go phase, which goes from that point to death. But what's the key you do, Chris, to that $45,000 you help them come up with, that December 31st dollar? What do you now do?
Well, we call that $45,000 in-house your base general desired number. We don't usually call it that to clients. That's an internal term we use. But that base number, we tell people, you know what? You gave us this, but we have found in the past that whatever people tell us, they usually spend more than that initially in retirement because they have all this time on their hands. And even though they were imagining being retired and what they would do, people almost always, not everybody, some people have very vivid dreams about what they want to do and they get a little carried away. But most people we found underestimate their spending early on in the go-go years. And so we take their base number and increase it. We bump it by default. We have some default approaches, but we let people tweak this for their own expectations and requirements or whatever you want to call it, however they want us to model it. But our base default approach is to take the go-go period and increase the base number by 20% to reflect what I just described, more activity typically in that go-go phase. Then in the slow-go period, we still reference that base number because remember you told us that's the number that you thought would keep you pleased and happy with the fun you had in any given year. And we take the base number, but we reduce it. You're in the slow go, right? We reduce it by, say, 10% in our default approach.
We're not reducing the increased number. We reduce the original base.
Right.
So from the increased number, it's actually a steeper drop.
Right, about 30% for rough math from the go-go to the slow go. And then when you hit the no-go phase, at whatever age we've agreed, we're going to transition that in the projections for you, It's going to be another reduction. We take that base number, and by default, we're only reducing it, and this surprises a lot of people, 20%. Remember, we dropped it by 10, the base dropped by 10, then the base dropped by 20. That actually is pretty optimistic for spending, but we do that intentionally. And we do that intentionally because what we don't want is people to hit the no-go phase and still be healthy and active and wanting to spend money, but we failed to look at what it would look like, the burden on their finances, if they were still going out and doing lots of things. So what we want to show you is if your assets, if this number we've come up with so far, if your assets look like they could support spending, even in the no-go phase, at a reduced amount, but not drastically reduced where you're just sitting around on the porch doing nothing, but still a pretty substantial amount, which we, Jim and I, always talk about and point out to people, most people don't end up spending that much in the no-go phase, what we're modeling here, but we wanted to show it to you in case you are one of those people, and there's more and more every day with advances in healthcare and all the neat things they're doing now, people taking care of themselves as well. Longevity is happening to a lot of people, and not only just lingering on barely, but longevity with health is happening to more and more people. So we want to look at that, we want to project the reality of reduced spending in each of the slow go and the no go phase as it applies again to your fun spending only. This has nothing to do with, we don't do this trajectory or the glide path to your minimum dignity floor. That behaves completely different. It's not based on aging and desire and things like that. There's other driving forces there. But that's the base default approach, and that can be tweaked for any particular client or clients if they wish.
And now you understand why we call it the glide path. Mm-hmm. It starts high and slowly begins to come down and keeps coming down until death. So that's the glide path. And then we apply that spending structure, that spending glide path, to your portfolio. In other words, negative cash withdrawals. Again, we believe that fun spending need not be annuitized and covered with lifetime guaranteed secure income, because fun spending is very emotional, very volatile. You could cut it if you had to. We don't believe in running out and buying an annuity or making sure you work longer to grow a bigger pension so you can cover fun spending. We think fun spending should be covered by your assets, and then you just position your assets appropriately. And we'll talk about that in another show on what we call bucketing and how you can protect that spending. But now, why are we doing this phase? Well, we're going to apply these negative cash flows to your portfolio to look for trends. Mm-hmm. We are not looking for accuracy in dollar amounts on what your portfolio is going to be worth, because those projections are just pie in the sky. You read any prospectus, it says past performance is no guarantee of future results. Yet at this phase, everybody wants to see what their future results are going to look like based on past performance of the investment markets. We're not looking for any of that. What we're looking for are the trends. And what do you mean the trends, Jim? There's only one of three things your portfolio's value is going to be doing at this point. Number one, dropping. And don't panic on that, folks. It's supposed to. I got news for you. I would say anecdotally, because we never really crunched these numbers, but I deliver probably 85% of the plans here in the office. Chris does the rest. I would say 30 to 40% of everyone that we work with, their portfolio is dropping at this point in the analysis. And that doesn't freak Chris out, and it doesn't freak me out, unless it drops so much to the point it runs out. And that does happen. And that does happen with a good percentage of our, I won't say a good percentage, a very small percentage of our clients, but it does happen. Mm-hmm. And at that point, it's purely driven by fund spending. We know that because we already took care of their minimum dignity floor. Right. No one has ever failed at the minimum dignity floor level. No one. I've been doing this 21 years. Now, that might speak volumes of the people who hire us, because I'm sure there are some people out there who do fail.
Right.
But we have never had a failure where we have to say, you can't retire. We have had a failure at this phase where we say, you can't retire under the spending you want to do. You either have to work longer, save more, or cut your expenses, as well as a few other things. So your portfolio could be dropping. And as long as it doesn't run out, if it drops to levels that seem reasonable, there's nothing wrong with it. But we will admit to people at this point, with a dropping portfolio, it does limit the adjustments you might want to voluntarily make to your preliminary fund number. Now, those adjustments are going to be our last podcast next week. So I'm not going to get too deep into them. But a dropping portfolio means it might be difficult to attend to optional reductions in your fund number. And we'll get into what those are next week. So if your portfolio's not dropping, I said there's only three things your portfolio's doing. Maybe the trends are showing your portfolio is growing, the opposite of dropping. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a very good sign. Mm-hmm. Because that says not only can you support your minimum dignity floor with your assets and available lifetime income and any reserve you have to make, it is easily covering your initial go-go, slow-go, no-go fund spending glide path, and it's continuing to increase, or at least the trends are indicating that the portfolio might continue to increase. That opens the door to perhaps retiring early, perhaps spending more on go-go, perhaps addressing some of the optional adjustments in a more positive manner. And we're going to get into those adjustments next week. That's kind of my teaser to keep people listening to next week. We'll go over.
I'm not going to give it away, but these are other things people might want to reserve money for or spend money on that don't cleanly fall into the minimum dignity floor and fun stuff two categories.
Exactly.
There's other categories. We consider them optional because not everyone is even interested in doing anything in those other categories. Other people find it very important to do things in every one of these other categories. So just that's what we're talking
Absolutely.
About.
Absolutely. So if the portfolio trends are rising, as you crunch these numbers, folks, if you're doing it yourself, this is very good. It opens the door to a lot of potential. If it's dropping, first of all, don't panic. It's supposed to. You're supposed to consume the money. If your portfolio is rising, one of our first questions are, is a goal of yours to optimize your assets you leave? Or is a goal of yours to consume your deferred spending yourself? Well, gee, Jim, I'd like to spend it myself. Why? Because it's growing so you can spend more. Gee, Jim, I really want to make sure my children can inherit some assets. Why? I think you're going to be able to do it. So that's what you have to look at if your portfolio is rising. Mm-hmm. So if it's not rising, Chris, and it's not dropping, what else is it doing?
Spinning round and round.
treading, like treading water. Mm-hmm. It just is kind of staying level that you enter your retirement phase with 2.7 million in our example
2.3.
of 2.3 million in our example of preliminary fund number. And we project at 93, which is the age of mortality in our plan, unless people override it and want us to go longer. You're still projected to have about $2.3 million. Now, we do show people that $2.3 million in the future isn't really $2.3 million today, so we will reduce that or adjust it to a real number. That first number is called a nominal dollar amount. The real dollar amount is an estimate of what we think if inflation averaged a certain level, what those dollars would be worth. Instead of using the word inflation, when I'm delivering a plan, though, I use the term lost spending or spending decline, because the U.S. dollar does decline. All dollars, all fiat currencies are declining every single year. So we need to put that in to give you a better perspective, Because if we didn't do that, you're going to think, oh, wow, I'm going to have still some pretty good money in 30 years. Nope, the reality is your portfolio is declining. It's not doing it on a nominal level, but on a real level it is. And once again, we got to look at that potential real drop. So make sure you adjust, folks. We look at graph one and graph three more on the nominal level, but if you are trending the just straight across, I'm going to look at that at a real level. But we do use a real level even on if it's rising or dropping. We will still adjust for real, especially on a dropping portfolio, because on a nominal level, it might look, hey, it's dropping, but I'm not running out. But on a real level, you're thinking, oh, my Lord, I'm getting really low. And we need to show that. So make sure at this phase you also adjust for the declining value of the dollar. Now, you have to choose your own rate of inflation to reflect that decline. Chris and I have defaulted in the office to 3%. Higher than typical, what the government is saying, the typical cost of living adjustments in the U.S., the typical inflationary pressures are over the last 10 years, which have been about 1.8%, but on average from the 70s of about 3%. So we use 3%, and we'd rather err on the side of caution. If we used a lower number, it makes the numbers look better. If we look at a higher number, it makes the numbers look worse. So we don't want to put 10 in. Very few people are going to have enough money to support a 10% decline in their dollars. But 3% we think is reasonable and explainable and defendable. So we happen to use 3. You can use more or less, but make sure you adjust this graph you're trying to come up with for the real dollar. And that is what's going to allow you to start making some decisions. Should you retire early? Well, if your portfolio is dropping and then adjusted for real dollars, it's dropping even more and it's starting to get you nervous and you haven't even discussed or factored in any of the optional reductions of your preliminary fund number, you might not want to consider retiring then. Or you have to look at reducing your fund spending and maybe that's not acceptable to you. Hey, I'm not happy with my job. I'd love to leave it. But God, Chris, I want to leave it and do these fun things, so I'm going to work a little longer. I want to do the fun things. Yes, I want to leave, but I'm going to work longer. Or other people will say, nope, I'm done. I can't go back. And they'll ask Chris, how much can I reduce it by or should I reduce it by? And you can start factoring these things in or we can start factoring in if I'm working with someone. But that's what you're looking for in this phase. Or if you're thinking about buying a second home, we're asked that a lot. Can I afford to buy this second home or this piece of property? Or the couple today I was talking about were thinking of buying or paying for some of the college for their niece and nephews. They didn't know if they could afford it or not. Well, I don't know until I crunch the numbers. If their portfolio was rising, yeah, I think you could. Depends how you handle the three adjustments, these optional adjustments to your preliminary fund number. But if the portfolio is dropping and then adjusted for inflation, the real drop, it's looking really bad, then no, maybe you can't afford to cover the college for your niece and nephew. So that's what you're looking in this phase of the analysis. It's not your final fund number yet. There are three more adjustments Chris and I are going to walk our people who work with us through, and if you're doing it yourself, that you need to take into consideration. Some people listening, you're going to think, as Chris said, I want all three of those. Other people, I don't want any of them. Or a lot of people, I want two, but not that one. Mm-hmm. Or I want one, but not those other two. Mm-hmm. These are optional reductions to your preliminary fund number. But anything you want to add, Chris, on this go-go, slow-go, no-go fun phase of the analysis?
Not really. I think we've covered it pretty well. We described how we build it, the reasons why we treat it differently than the minimum dignity floor expenses. This is another thing that bothers me about 99% of the retirement plans that are delivered to people. They treat all expenses as one is just as important as another and as The classic thing that really bugs me is that by showing you the linear spending, they'll make a comment like, oh, when you're younger, some of that you're spending is going to go on fun stuff. But then as you age, you're going to do less fun, which will help you afford the more expensive medical expenses that we expect. That's like waving your hands at a problem without really addressing it. That's just kind of not wanting to look at it any deeper and to just make some comment like those things just naturally offset one another dollar for dollar. That's like, it just doesn't work that way in life. And that's just I believe, a lazy way of planning because you're not really investigating your true circumstances in that regard. So we talked about why we approach it this way. And a lot of people, if that fun budget that they gave us is truly what they want to do and nothing more, they have no interest in spending more, they'll have a pretty good idea at this point, even without going beyond this, going to what Jim and I call the final fun number, which is coming at this, how much could I spend on fun stuff from the other direction? What could my assets support rather than, I want to do this. Can my assets support it? Which is this first approach where you've given us the budget and we're just telling you if the trends in your asset trajectory look like they could support that level of spending. If they've given us a number that there's just nothing else they want to do, they've got pretty good clarity at this point of the likelihood of a successful retirement for them based on the cash flows they've described to us, their situation, their living circumstances, and the basic assumptions that we've put into the plan.
Excellent. So that summarizes this phase of our process. Next week, we're going to get into the last two phases. And you might be thinking, oh my God, two more phases? How much longer is this? These next two phases, very, very simple and easy. Mm-hmm. We'll have them summarized in 10 minutes. I kid you not. 10 minutes. These last two phases move quickly. But they're the last two elements that we offer, and they're two elements that you guys need to factor in if you're trying to do this yourself. Now, they're easier to describe, but they're, in my opinion, as difficult to project, but much easier to describe.
True. That's true.
They're not easy mm-hmm. to project.
The concept of what we're doing is quite simple, straightforward, understandable. Actually coming up with the numbers that are in this category can be very challenging.
I can all but guarantee you, unfortunately, yeah. Do-it-yourselfers.
This will be a tough one.
The fourth element. The third element, you can do. Just going to have to adjust your spreadsheet a little. The fourth element, most of you aren't going to be able to do it. But I'll walk you through what it is and why you're not going to be able to do it on your own. And we have to use very sophisticated software because we wouldn't be able to do it with a calculator and a spreadsheet. It just too many moving parts to the numbers to do that without software help. But it doesn't mean our whole process isn't going to work for you do-it-yourselfers. It will. You're just going to have to approach the fourth element differently. But we're going to go over those two, and I believe we will have adequate time to go into the three optional adjustments to this preliminary minimum dignity floor and help you come up with what we consider to be your final fund number and pull all this together. So our goal is to have it all done next week, five total shows, but there's no guarantee. There might be a sixth or a five and a half.
I think we can do it.
But that's our goal, is to wrap this all up. There's a few more elements. Okay. But I hope you guys got the concept of how you need to be crunching these numbers.
If you want to take our approach.
And you don't have to.
Lots of different ways to do it.
We're just sharing you what we believe in and what we do it. Okay, so I wanted you to know that. Now, at this phase of our podcast, we always say our goodbyes, and then Chris usually takes over and says, we are living, breathing, practicing financial planners in the state of Colorado, and if you would like to schedule a call, we call it a coffee and a second opinion. You can visit our website, and if you think we might be able to help you, here's how you can do that. But we've got to change this, and this was a very difficult decision I pretty much made on my own, but I did counsel with every staff member, and especially Chris. And Chris, you hands down agreed we needed to do this.
At this point, yes.
At this point. Mm-hmm. And what are we talking about? Effective February 1st, so by time you listen to this, it's past February 1st, Chris and I have paused taking on new clients. It's not something we entered into lightly. I mean, my goodness, we are business owners, and clients are the lifeblood of any business. But we had, in our opinion, an unprecedented amount of people hire us recently. Now, that sounds very ominous, but we're a small firm. So the amount of people who recently hired us might have been a laugh for some of these bigger RIA firms. They would have been, really? That's nothing. I get four times that amount. But to us, it was a lot. We have a very, as you can tell, a very stringent, a very disciplined, a very methodical approach to retirement. We take a lot of time to do our programming. So we decided, in the best interest, and I hate using that word because it's overused now, but in the best interest of our existing clients who feel almost abandoned at times, and we apologize for that, and our new clients who are waiting for us to bring them on and program them into our system and start giving them advice, we felt we needed to control our potential new clients. So if you go to our website, we explain all that under our calendar. But we did not close the calendar. And I did not reduce the amount of people I am willing to talk to see if we can help people. Only thing we did was stop new people from coming into the queue. But you're more than welcome to counsel with us, to see if we can help you, to explain to you our process, to see if you even like it, to explain to you our pricing structure, and how you can work with us. And then what we tell you is, if you want to come on, start collecting your data, here's everything we're going to need, and then just wait. And when we unlock the door or unpause, I like Laura is the one who came up with the word pause. Mm-hmm. When you click resume, or when we click resume, everyone is going to get an email, and we're going to tell you, okay, we're open again. So if you've done your homework and collected all your data and you're ready to go, start sending it in. The guys are ready to start taking on new clients. We don't want to disappoint a potential new client, especially those who need an answer faster than we're going to be able to get it to them. So that's why we've done this. And we're not going to explain this every show. We just wanted you listeners to know that we did pause, but we're still taking initial calls. We're still going to chat to you, explain to you our cost structure, our pricing, how we work. If you need a retirement decision made, I would say over the next 6 months or so, go somewhere else, please. I mean, don't wait for us. We can't guarantee we're going to unpause in 6 months. But if you're not retiring for another year or two or three or four or more, and you like our approach and you want to chat with us to see if we could help you, you're not going to notice anything different. Anyways, anything
and we're
you
bringing on
add?
We're bringing on new resources, but it'll take some ramp up time. Yeah. This growth happened, you know, in kind of all of a sudden
and faster than we could dial
up the resources. So we're in the process of doing so, and when we get that, we'll be able to handle more people and still deliver the same quality of product that we demand. So we are trying to address this.
Exactly. We are interviewing what Chris is saying. We are interviewing. We just recently hired another CPA for the tax part, and we are interviewing financial planners, CFPs, to come on board and work with us. We never say for us. You're going to come work with us as a team. The problem is, as we hire people, our approach and process, Chris, as you know, is so unique. There is no software that does all this. We use different programs. We wrote Excel spreadsheets. We have our own approach. So the learning curve is a lot deeper for a new person, and we don't get as much efficiency out of them as we would if we were using a more regurgitative type program, mm-hmm. where you type in a few numbers, click calculate, probability statistic comes out, the software prints a PDF, and you hand it to a client with a probability statistic and say next. Our approach is a lot deeper. So yes, we are trying to hire some additional staff to help us with this. and then we may be able to unpause as we're putting it.
And also just remind people, this is actually, we're recording this on January 31st, 2020. So if you're listening to this 2 years from now,
ignore
might
that
be very, very
last
different.
Tirade.
Hopefully it's a
I
very different
led
story.
With that.
Yeah. So
somebody listens to this in 2 years and thinks, oh, darn, I wanted to talk to these guys.
So it's here for the next few months here at the beginning of 2020, we'll be in this status most likely. But we'll let everybody know when we're ready to take on new people again. And we'll just keep working as hard as we can to deliver stuff to the current people in our queue. And,
excellent.
That's
so again, if you're still a year or two or three or four or five from retirement and you were wondering about talking to us now, now is a great time. The worst time to do retirement planning, folks, is 6 months before you intend to retire or a year or two before you intend to retire. You should be crunching these numbers 5 to 10 years before retirement. That's our own preference.
Ten's on the long side, I will tell you. That's a long stretch. I like five. Five feels really good to me as the one who's crunching it, mm-hmm. only because it's close enough where you have pretty good reliability on the numbers and your vision and what you really want to do. When people get out closer to 10, there's usually way too many, gee, I haven't really thought about that, or I don't know when I'm going to do this, or, you know.
I agree.
Even the retirement date. So it can be done, but kind of, I think 5 to 7 is the sweet spot.
I was going
to
say 5 to 8.
Yeah, oh, close.
Somewhere around there. Okay, so if you're still that far away, a year or two or three or four or eight, don't worry about it. You can still schedule a coffee and a second opinion and get in this queue till when we unpause, if you will. But honestly, if you're needing an answer sometime this year, we're going to encourage you to find counsel somewhere else, and hopefully that will all work out for you. We're just trying to be honest. We don't want to set expectations too high. Or do it yourself. This is the whole reason we're also going through this 5, maybe 6 series of podcasts. We want people who like our approach. I don't know of any other firm that does it the way we do, and I'm sure there's some out there. I really do. But I don't know of any offhand, so I've got no one to send people to. But you might be able to do it yourself now that you mm-hmm. understand our basic concepts, mm-hmm. get some preliminary numbers yourself and see how those come up.
Right.
So anyways, people...
Maybe we should write a book.
We'll write a book. But I'm sorry to bore you all with it. We just wanted our listeners to know that because a lot of our clients, most of our clients come through referrals. But we do get a lot coming in from the podcast every now and then. We wanted people to know that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks, everybody, for listening. And we'll tie everything up with the next show in our process. So we'll see you next week.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.